We are up to explaining the last phrase in the Mishnah, and that is that the world stands on Gemilus Chasadim. On Gemilus Chasadim. We explained already why the world stands on Torah and on Avodah, and now we'll finish up the idea of Gemilus Chasadim. The most basic, simplest idea is that without people doing kindnesses one to the other, society can't exist. Can't have a functioning society if people don't help each other. And people don't, even more than help each other, don't provide each other with the needs that they have, and the everybody contributes what they have to contribute and receive what they need to receive. And that's the way that you have a functioning society. So the world, the functioning of the world as we know it, depends on Gemilus Chasadim. But it's much, much deeper than that. First of all, the Torah says, the Navi says, Olam Chesed Yibone. The world is based, and God created the world for the sake of Chesed. The idea being the following. Why did God create the world altogether? Why did God need a creation? So even though it is beyond our comprehension to express and to understand why God needs anything, because God doesn't need anything. If he needs something, then he's missing something, and God can't be missing anything. So to understand God's will is almost impossible, if not impossible. But God revealed to us what we can understand about the purpose of creation. It's not that we can understand the purpose of creation, but we can understand what God wants us to understand about the purpose of creation. Let me explain what that means before we, and why I said that. In general, what the rabbis tell us the purpose of creation is that God, being the ultimate good, wanted to shower his creation with that good. He wanted to do good for those who could receive the good. And he wanted the good that he would shower those creations with to be the ultimate good, which is himself. So God created a being called our neshamos that could receive a relationship with him eternally. And that's the ultimate good. But God knew that if he showered that goodness on the soul automatically, without the soul earning it, it wouldn't be appreciated completely. It wouldn't be the ultimate good. Because people don't appreciate what they don't earn. It's called Nahama Dechsufa, bread that you're embarrassed to eat because it's given to you for free. And therefore the Rabbanu Shalom put our neshamos into this physical world where we can earn, even more specifically, create that relationship with him. Instead of him creating it with us, we create it with him by doing things in this world that make our neshamos more godlike. The foundation of that is Torah and mitzvahs, and that applies not only to Jews, it applies to Goyim too. They also have their mitzvahs. And from there we learn what is godlike and what's not godlike. And in everything we do, eating, drinking, conducting our business life, married life, whatever it may be, can be done in a way that's more godlike or less godlike. If you do it more godlike, you make your soul more like God, and therefore create a closer bond with him after 120 years. If you do things in a less godlike way, you break that bond. You distance yourself from God. You have less of a relationship with him. So we basically create our relationship with God. We create our world to come. We don't just earn it. That's more or less, in a nutshell, the purpose of creation that the rabbis tell us. There's only one big problem with that. And that is that if that's the reason why God created this world, he could have just created souls, attached himself to them, bonded with them for eternity, and fulfilled his purpose of showering his goodness on a creation. But God didn't do that because he knew that we wouldn't appreciate it completely, because people don't appreciate what they don't earn. Then God could have saved a lot of time and money. He didn't have to create this world. All he had to do was change one rule. Who made that rule? Who said that people can't appreciate what they don't earn? Who made that rule? Obviously God. So why can't God change that rule? Why couldn't he create souls that can appreciate what they don't earn? Then he wouldn't have had to create this world. He just would have had to create souls, attach himself to them, and just take away that problem that souls can't appreciate what they don't earn. Make souls that appreciate what they don't earn. There is a partial answer to that, because in order to have that relationship with God, you have to be more like God. And if you are a receiver, God gives you that perfection, then you're not like God, because God receives nothing. But if you are the master of your perfection, you create it, then you're more like God. That does not really answer the question completely, because you're not like God in that way either. God doesn't create his perfection. He is perfect. He doesn't have to create anything. So just as much as God doesn't receive anything, he doesn't make anything for himself to make himself more perfect either. So a human being who makes himself more perfect is not any more like God than a human being who receives perfection from somebody else. So what is the answer to that question? The answer is, there is no answer. There is no way of understanding the answer to that question. Why? Because it's out of our realm. It's a question on God's mind. Why couldn't God have created the world differently? That's a question beyond this world, before the creation, in God's mind. It's something that our minds have no, we can't fathom. And if you don't think that's true, I'll give you two examples. First example, close your eyes and picture nothing. Okay? Don't close them too tight, because I don't want to be the only person awake over here.
It's so hard to do.
Picture nothing. Nothing. Okay? You have nothing pictured in your mind. Some people walk around like that their whole life. Picture nothing in your mind. Okay? Now take your hand and put it into your mind's thinking of nothing. Is your hand now inside that nothing? Okay, that's not nothing. That's space. Now try again. Picture nothing, no space. Don't even bother, you get a headache. You can't picture no space. You know why? Because we have no connection to that. We live in a world where there's space. It's beyond our framework. It's outside of our realm. So we can't even imagine nothing, let alone what's in God's mind before the creation of the world. I'll give you one more example, easier one. Picture something you never saw and never heard of. Impossible. Because if you never saw and never heard of it, how could you possibly picture it? The most you can do is picture a monster with 10 heads, 4 arms, 6 legs, but all of those things you heard or saw. You're just making a combination. I'm talking about picturing something that no part of it did you ever see or hear of. It's impossible. It's beyond your comprehension, or mine for that matter too, because it's out of our realm completely. And therefore, Chazal say, you're not allowed to ask what came before the world, or what's beyond the world. Not so much because it's prohibited, but it's impossible. Because our frame of reference is what is in this world, from the creation and on. What was before the creation is out of our realm completely. What's beyond this universe is out of our realm completely. There's no way that we can fathom it. And therefore the question, why did God create the world the way he did, and not a different way? Why couldn't he have changed the rules, is a question that's outside this realm. It's in God's mind. That's not something that we could possibly answer. So then what can we understand? Once God created the world the way he did, why did he, what can we understand about it? That's all. Not why couldn't he create differently, but once he created it as he did, what can we understand about it? So once the rules are as they are, that people appreciate what they earn, that's a given fact. Now we can understand, based on that, why God created this world, what we can understand about it. That's all, nothing more than that. In any case, therefore, God's creation of the world is an expression of his midas hachesed. It is total kindness. God wanted to shower his kindness on a creation, and that is the entire purpose, and everything else that comes from that. All the rest of how God deals with the world, reward and punishment and everything is just to complete that kindness in the most positive and most effective way. And therefore, there has to be a chance to have free choice. Because if you don't have free choice, then you're a robot. And you're just given the kindness on a silver platter. But if you have free choice, and you can earn that kindness, and you also can lose it, then if you earn it, you appreciate it. And because God doesn't want anybody to lose it, so he also has mercy. Right? Even though he rewards and he punishes, but he has mercy. And he also created corrections for people who do the wrong thing, that eventually they can get that kindness that God wanted. And all those corrections are, in this world, suffering sometimes brings a person to change his ways, or after death there's Gehenom, which atones for the sins corrects a neshama that was sullied. And all these things are just to finish off that chesed. And that's why it's called Gemilus Chasodim. Gemila means to be finished. That's why weaning a child is called Gemila. You finish the nursing of that child. That's why in modern Hebrew, right, being weaned from drugs, right, going to a drug rehabilitation is called Gemila. Gomel has a connection to the word gomer, to finish. And therefore, when people are gomel chesed, they do kindness one to the other, they're emulating God. And they are finishing off the kindness that God created the world, that people should appreciate and should feel that connection to him and feel godlike. So people who do kindness to others, right, are emulating God and finishing off his kindness by making this world a place where people do kindness one to the other. That's called Gemilus Chasodim. Okay, can I ask you to sit with the men? Excuse me. The men section over there. There's two men sections here, one up front and one over there. Everybody else is in the middle. If you want to sit up here, you could too also. But So that is chesed. God, in fact, the Medrash says the following. When God came to create the world, he asked the various angels their advice. What do they think? So the Medrash says that Emes said, forget it. Don't create human beings. They are kulo sheker. They're in totally falsehood. They're not Emes. So I suggest that you don't create man. He's not true. He's not Emes. Shalom said, don't create human beings. They're constantly fighting. Right? So Shalom said, forget it. The only one that said that God should create human beings is Chesed. The angel that represents kindness said people do kindnesses one for the other. So what did God do? It was two against one. Right? But he wanted to create man. So he threw Emes to the ground, and now it was one against one, and God broke the tie. And he created man. And the Emes now has to come from this world. Think, one of the ideas being, the absolutes in this world don't exist. Shalom is an absolute. Perfection. Like we explained last week. Or 2 weeks ago. Emes is an absolute. Either it's true or it's not true. You can't have something that's partially true. If it's partially true, the part that's true is 100% true, and the part that's false is 100% false. So Emes and Shalom are, what's it called, are ideas of absolutes. Thanks, Uli. They're absolutes. Chesed is not an absolute. Chesed is relative, and just the opposite. It's based on the fact that people aren't perfect. Because if everybody would be perfect, there'd be no place to do chesed. Everybody would have everything. In fact, that's what we say in the Bracha Achrona, Borei Nefoshos. Borei Nefoshos Rabos V'Chesronon. God created many, many souls, many things in this world, and the things that they're lacking, Al Kol Masha Barasa, and what they're lacking, He made other things provide their need. So, I'm lacking something, and you have that, you can provide what I'm lacking. You're lacking something, and I have that, I can provide what you're lacking. So God created imperfect beings, but everyone's imperfect in a different way, and has a different perfection. And therefore, if we work together, I can provide what you need, and you can provide what I need. And that's how the world gets along. So the entire creation was created for chesed, for God to perform or to fulfill His chesed to the world, to shower His kindness on the world. And He created in such a way that people will earn His kindness by doing kindness with others, and by perfecting others and being perfected by others. So therefore, if it says the world stands on chesed, it's much more than just chesed provides a functioning society. But chesed is the entire foundation of why the world was created. And chesed is the entire foundation of how the world exists. So that is, what's it called? That is another aspect of this idea of chesed. There is an even deeper idea of why the world exists because of chesed. There is a connection between chesed and emunah. And we've spoken about this in the past. I'm not going to go into too much detail about it, but I want to repeat the idea, and then we will have finished this Mishnah. Where do we find this connection? Firstly, there's a medrash that says the following. Kol ha-gomil chesed, whoever performs kindness, does kindnesses between man and man, ke'ilu molde b'chol ha-nisim sh'asa kadosh baruch hu b'otzianu mitzrayim, as if he believes in all the miracles that God did when we left Egypt. V'chol she'eino gomil chesed ke'ilu kofir. And a person who doesn't do kindness is as if he denies those miracles. So belief in God and in miracles depends on doing chesed, which on the surface doesn't seem to make any sense, because there are a lot of people in this world who do a lot of chesed and don't believe anything. And there are people who believe a lot and don't do any chesed. So how could it be that they depend on each other? That they're dependent? Chesed and emunah, where's the connection? Chesed is bein odom lechaveiro, between man and man, and emunah is between man and God. There's another place we see this connection. Avram Avinu was the Amud HaChesed. Avram Avinu excelled in kindness. That was Avram Avinu's hallmark, whereas Yitzchak was Avoda and Yaakov was Torah. But Chesed was Avram Avinu. Titein Emes LeYaakov, Chesed LaAvram. Chesed. And Avram, at the same time, was Rosh HaMaminim. He was the choice believer. So we see that belief and chesed go together. Believing in God and doing chesed somehow go together. So what is the connection between belief in God and chesed? I'm going to tell you two ideas. The first one's going to take a while. The second one will take a few seconds. Let's start with the first one. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman asks the following questions. The Bahag, the Baal Halachos Gedolos, one of the early commentaries, Rishonim, he says that there is not a mitzvah to believe in God. It's not one of the 613 mitzvahs, because it is a foundation before any mitzvah could be. And it can't be a mitzvah. Why? Because you can have a mitzvah. Mitzvah means a command. You can have a command if you believe in a commander. I can come to you and say, look, you believe in God. I'm telling you that God said you should keep Shabbos. So Shabbos could be a mitzvah. The commander, God, who you believe in, said you should keep Shabbos. But if you don't believe in God, I can't come and tell you God said there's a mitzvah to believe in him. Because if you don't believe in him, who said? And if you do believe in him, then he doesn't have to tell you to believe in him. You already believe in him. So there can't be a mitzvah to believe in God. If you accept that foundation, then there can be mitzvahs from the God that you believe in. If you don't believe in God, you can't get started. There can't be anyone commanding you to do anything because you don't believe in him. So therefore, emunah, belief in God, is not a mitzvah. It is before mitzvahs. It's a foundation. So says the Bahag, the way the Rishon the Ramban explains it. That's why he doesn't count emunah as one of the 613 mitzvahs. Comes along the Rambam, and the Rambam counts belief in God as one of the 613 mitzvahs. So the obvious question is, to whom is this mitzvah? If you believe already, you don't need a mitzvah. And if you don't believe, there can't be a mitzvah. Because if you don't believe, who's commanding you? So who's this mitzvah for? For believers, it's unnecessary, and for non-believers, it's impossible. First question. Second question. Torah says, Lo sasuru achrei levavchem v'acharei neichem. Don't go after your heart and your eyes. Your eyes refers to immorality. I understand that. You are drawn to immorality by what you see. But your heart refers to minus. Minus means false ideologies, false philosophies, false beliefs. Why does it say go after your heart? Your heart is emotion. Should say, don't go after your mind. Where are false ideologies and false philosophies in your mind, in your intellect? It should have said, don't go after your head. Don't go after your mind, but not your heart. Your heart is more emotion. So why does it say, why does it describe going after your heart to describe believing in false ideologies? And the third question he asks is, every 12-year-old girl and 13-year-old boy is required to believe in God. Whereas Aristotle, who the Rambam says reached the highest level of intellect, short of a prophet, didn't believe in God. So if Aristotle, with all his wisdom, couldn't believe in God, how do we demand from every 13-year-old boy and 12-year-old girl to believe in God? It's not fair. Aristotle didn't believe in God. How could you expect from every 13-year-old and 12-year-old to believe in God? Those are, yes, more, but those are basically the three questions he asked. The answer he gives is the following. He said that if a person would be objective, he would look at this world in an objective way, he'd have to conclude that there was an intelligent creator that created the world. Wasn't planning on doing that, but we'll do it anyway. We have some time. If I were to ask you, how did this tape recorder get here? Two possibilities. Both are possible. I want to know which is more probable. That the Sony Corporation has people who assemble tape recorders, who know how to assemble tape recorders, and they assembled this. One possibility. Second possibility. There were millions and millions of pieces, of electronic pieces on this table. And over many, many, many years, the window was open and the wind kept blowing them off the table. And one time it blew the pieces off the table and they formed this tape recorder. By accident. Just by pure coincidence and chance. But it happened many, many, many times. There was a big pile of parts and many times they fell off the table and just fell haphazardly. But one time they fell together. Which do you think, both are possible, which do you think is more probable?
The first.
The first. Anybody think the second one is more probable? Okay. The second possibility. Second question, a dictionary. Okay. Two possibilities how that dictionary got written. One is that someone who knows how to write dictionaries wrote the dictionary and published it. Second possibility. There were an infinite amount of monkeys typing on an infinite amount of keyboards over many, many, many years. And haphazardly, just one time, by accident, they typed out that dictionary. Again, both are possible. Which do you think is more probable? first way. Yeah? Okay. So far, you're batting 1,000. Okay, next possibility. Next question. The human eye. The human eye is more complicated, more complex than this tape recorder. Much more orderly than a dictionary. Okay, how did it get here? Two possibilities. One possibility, there is an intelligent creator that created the human eye, put it together and makes it function. Just like there's an intelligent creator that created a camera. Okay, and the human eye is much more complex than the most complex camera. Another possibility. Possible. There were hydrogen atoms floating in space. Where the hydrogen atoms came from and where space came from is the free space on the bingo card. We don't have any idea where those came from, but they just happen to be the space and the hydrogen atoms, because you got to start with something. Okay, and over millions and millions of years, the hydrogen atoms are very happy being hydrogen atoms. But all of a sudden, for some inexplicable reason, the hydrogen atoms decided to implode, and they fused and became helium atoms. And from the helium atoms became more complex atoms and more, until we got the whole periodic table after the Big Bang, and now we have all the materials that go, the building blocks of nature, and we have these big stars that are formed. And stars are very happy just being their stars, doing whatever stars do, until, by accident, right, at one point in time, two of these stars came very close to each other, and one of them pulled some material from one star and set it going around the other star, and that was the beginning of our solar system, with everything going around the sun. Now, in order for that to be true, everything has to be going the same way, because all the material was pulled off and set spinning around this star in the same direction. The only problem with that is that they've discovered in the last 50 years, 60 years, that there are certain parts of our solar system, certain moons of certain planets that go retrograde, that go the opposite way. Doesn't fit the theory, unless somebody decided to push it the other way or whatever, but in any case, doesn't fit the theory, but you have to believe that it could happen, that it could go against the laws of science too. Okay, so now we have a bunch of masses going around the star. Many of them were too close to the star to support life. They were too hot. Many of them were too far away from this star to support life. They were too cold. But just like Goldilocks' porridge, there was one that was just right, by accident, in the middle. Not too hot, not too cold, right in the middle, called the Earth. And the Earth was able to support a atmosphere and able to have water. And because of that, the water had in it all of the building blocks of life. Proteins and all the different kinds of building blocks of life. Now, what does that mean, building blocks of life? That means that those are things that life contain, but they're not living. So one day, a lightning bolt hit these building blocks of life, which were in the soup of the sea, and all of a sudden they became a living creature, a living amoeba. Now, scientists have been trying to do that on purpose by putting all the amino acids and proteins that make up life in a liquid and running a current through it and turning it into something living. And they can't do it. They can only do it in science fiction. But they can't do it really. So something that can't be done on purpose was done by accident. Total blind accident. Okay, you have to believe. To believe this, you have to be a real believer. So you have to believe that it could happen. Okay, it could happen. It doesn't happen often. Didn't happen any time since then. But it happened once. Okay. So now we have an amoeba. Now, the amoeba was very happy being an amoeba. It carries on all the functions of life, right? It wasn't missing anything. But after millions and millions of years, just by accident, one day an amoeba, instead of dividing up, right, into another amoeba, it divided up into a paramecium. It had a mutant. Now, usually today, mutations are negative things. But you have to believe that then there could be mutations that were positive. Okay, so there was a positive mutation, and the amoeba had a paramecium instead of another amoeba. You know what that's like? It's much more than the following. Woman goes to the hospital to have a baby, and she's in the delivery room, and the doctor says, "Mazel tov, it's a giraffe." The woman said, "Giraffe? Boy or girl?" No, she said, he says, "Yeah, it's a giraffe." She said, "I wasn't really expecting a giraffe. I was expecting a little baby." He said, "Well, you know, sometimes you have babies, sometimes you have giraffes. You know, just a quirk. You had a mutation. Your kid is a giraffe, right? So you better get a sweater with a long neck or whatever." And you had a giraffe. A giraffe is more similar to a human being than a paramecium is to an amoeba. So for an amoeba to have a paramecium, a many-celled thing, is beyond comprehension. But it happened. Okay. But that didn't end there. Every once in a while, right, the things that went to the delivery room didn't have what they thought they were going to have. The paramecium had different things until there were fish. Now these fish just came by accident. They were mutants. They came by accident. But the fish, these accidental fish, were not only very, very smart, but prophetic. Because the fish were happy being fish. They had gills, they had scales, they had fins. What were they missing? But somehow they sensed that the rivers they were in were drying up. Now that weren't going to dry up the next day, because then it would have been futile. It means that they had this feeling that in about a million years, the rivers were going to dry up. So they started to have mutations of not fish, but amphibians, because they knew that if the waters would dry up, they would drown in the air if they only had gills. So they needed lungs. So they started to mutant children that were not fish with only gills, but fish with lungs too, which became amphibians. And then when the rivers dried up, these amphibians went onto the dry land. Now, at the same time that these prophetic fish were having these mutations that couldn't live in the water, so it had to be just precision, accidentally precision, that just at the right time they were able to go on the dry land. At the same time, the trees, plants, were evolving on the dry land so there would be food for the amphibians, because if they didn't evolve that food chain, they would have starved because there would be no food for amphibians to eat. So by accident, the total haphazard coincidence, the food chain also was evolving and happened to be coincide with these amphibians. Okay, so now you have amphibians. Some of them got tired of walking. They became birds after millions and millions of years. And some of them didn't. They became reptiles. Then there was mammals. The mammals evolved over millions and millions of years until one day, one of the apes opened the New York Times and became a human being. And that is how the human eye came about. Now, both of them are possible. Which is more probable? Here we have human beings who say that is much more probable it happened the second way. And believing that there's a God who created this world, that's for children. That's a fairy tale. But to believe that it evolved accidentally, which is not mathematically possible, not scientifically sound. I saw one of the great scientists of the early 1900s said that you have to be a bigger believer to believe in evolution than to believe in God. Evolution takes a tremendous amount of leap of faith to believe it because it's not scientific. In any case, so there are people who take that leap of faith when it comes to believing in evolution, but don't believe in God. Why? Why, when it comes to tape recorders and dictionaries, it's obvious that it's more probable there was someone who made the dictionary, who made the tape recorder. Therefore, it's more probable that there is an intelligent creator that created this world. Why has that become improbable and all of these haphazard, coincidental accidents become the more probable? The answer is not because it's more probable, not because it makes more sense, because people don't want to believe in a God. Because if I believe there's a God who created this world intelligently, that means he had a purpose for it. And if he had a purpose and I'm created for that purpose, then I have to fit the purpose that God created me for. I'll give you an example. When I really want to finish this today. So when I first came to Eretz Yisrael, I bought the first and last new car that I ever bought. I had rights. I didn't have to pay tax. I got a Ford van for about $8,000 at the time. And the shekel value at the time was 1,000 old shekel to the dollar. So the car cost 8 million shekel in old shekel. And in those days, this was about almost 27, 28 years ago, you couldn't buy a car and pay it off like any normal civilized country in the world. You had to pay it in total cash up front. You had to pay for it, finished. Couldn't pay it off. So I went and cashed $8,000 into 8 million shekel, had it in a attaché case, because the biggest bill they had was a 100 shekel bill. There was nothing bigger than that. So I had 8 million shekel in 100 shekel bills in an attaché case, and I had to go to Tel Aviv to pick up the car I had ordered a few months earlier. And I felt like a drug dealer carrying this attaché case full of a few million shekel. So I come to the Ford Motor Company in Tel Aviv, put my attaché case on the table, open it up. He starts inspecting to make sure that there's no blank paper over here. It's all 8 million shekel. And he gives me the keys to the car. As I'm leaving the place to get my car, he says, "Wait, I forgot something." So I was ready for anything, because when I ordered the car, he said, "I see you never ordered a new car, so would you like extras or you just want the basic car?" So I didn't know. I never bought a new car. I didn't know what extras I could have. So I figured maybe power windows, maybe a stereo. So I said to him, "Can you give me some examples of what extras I could possibly opt for?" He said, "Yeah, do you want windows?" I said, "What do you mean if I want windows?" He said, "Yeah, the car comes with a windshield and a back thing. But if you want side windows, that's extra." So I was ready for anything. The guy calls me back. "You forgot something." "What did you forget?" "I forgot to give you this book." Takes out this big, thick book. I said, "What's that?" He said, "That's the owner's manual to the car." "What's that?" "Tells you what kind of gas to put in the gas tank, right? Or for those from England, what kind of petrol to put in the gas tank." I don't know what you call it, a petrol tank. And what kind of oil to put in the crankcase, and what kind of detergent to use on the upholstery. And I felt like telling this guy, "What a chutzpah. I just gave you 8 million shekel in cold cash for this car. You're going to tell me what to do with it? I'll do whatever I want with it. I'll put whatever I want in the gas tank. I'll put whatever I want in the crankcase. You're going to tell me what to put in my car?" Obviously, that would have been ridiculous, because I didn't design the car. The Ford Motor Company designed the car. Unfortunately, they designed it to run on a certain grade of gasoline and not on water. If I can't redesign the car to run on water, I'm going to have to put gasoline and the grade of gasoline that they say. And if I don't put gasoline, the car won't go anywhere. And it may go if I put the wrong grade of gasoline, but it'll burn down the motor. So if I believe that there's a God who intelligently created this world and designed it, then I'm bound to his design. Not because he's bigger than me or greater than me or he can zap me with a lightning bolt, because he designed me. So he can tell me, I designed you to eat this, not to eat that. I designed you to wear this, not to wear that. Oh, you can do what you want. But if you eat the wrong things, you're burning out your motor. You'll burn your neshama out. You're not going to get where you're going. So if God designed me to eat kosher food and not kosher food, and I eat not kosher food, then I'm putting sugar in my gas tank. Or I'm putting the wrong grade of gasoline. It may look like I'm going, but eventually I'm going to burn out my motor. So I have to listen to God because he designed me. But if I don't believe that anybody designed me, I believe I just came by accident. Everything's an accident. Then whatever I do is okay. I don't have to bow or conform to any kind of design. There is no design. Everything's just a haphazard accident. I just came by accident. Everything's an accident. And not only that, if I believe that everything's just a haphazard accident, then there can't be any right and wrong. There can't be any morals in this world. Because how can there be right and wrong about an accident? An accident means that it's purposeless. So there can't be anything right or wrong about anything, or good or bad about anything. Everything's just an accident. There can't be anything wrong with stepping on an ant if the ant came by accident. It's just an accident. What could be wrong stepping on it? And Mamela, there can't be anything wrong with stepping on your aunt from Chicago either, because she's a bigger accident. There are more accidents went into her than into that little aunt. So there can't be anything wrong with murder, or the only thing wrong with it is that society can't exist if people murder each other. So that's called situational ethics. It's only right and wrong relative to what society can exist with. But if tomorrow we decide that society is killing Jews, then it's right to kill Jews. And that's what Nazi Germany became. They didn't have no laws. They had laws. The laws were corrupt because they made what was wrong into right, which very easily, because everything is relative. So if you consider Jews parasites and pests, so just like you can kill mice and rats, you can kill Jews too. So there can't be any morals if you don't believe that there's a God who created the world. There can only be situational ethics. So therefore, people deep down don't want to believe in God. They want to be free. So they, because they don't want to believe in God, that's why they don't believe in Him. Not because, if they be objective, they look at the world objectively, and their heart would not blind their eyes from seeing the truth, then people would be believers. The belief in God is something that is part of the psyche of human beings all the world over. They believe in a superior power that created this world. That is something that's common sociologically to all different peoples. Okay, they distort it and make it into Avodah Zarah, whatever. But they believe there is some power that created this world. There is nothing in the psyche of a human being that believes in evolution. That's something that is created by human beings. But deep down, every people all over the world believe in a superpower, something that created this world. It's there. It's part of the human mind. Because all you have to do is look at the world and you'll see there must have been a creator. But if you don't want to believe in a creator, it's a different story. And therefore, the Medrash says the following. When Moshe Rabbeinu was being dictated the Torah, and was dictated the sentence, Na'asa Adam, let us make man. So Moshe said, I can't write that. You're giving a place for the minim, the people who believe in more than one God, the early Christians, to have a proof from here. It says in the plural, let us make man. Obviously more than one God. There's a Trinity. Let us. Plural. So God told Moshe, you write, the harotza li toshita. You write, and whoever wants to make a mistake, let him make a mistake. Now that seems to be that God is very cynical and very insensitive to what he's causing people to make mistakes. You want to make a mistake? Make a mistake. God told us not to make people make mistakes. Not to aid people in doing sins. And he's aiding people in doing sins because he's writing something that fools people, that leads them to believe something different than is true. So why isn't God sensitive to that? So what the Bali Musar say is the following. Nobody ever became an apikoris because it says, let us make man. All you have to do is look at Rashi. Why does it say in the plural? Because God asked advice from the angels, like we said. And at the end of the sentence it says, Vayas Elohim in the singular. God made man. So when it says, let us make man, it's not the plural God's talking. It's God talking to the angels. Very simple. Nobody in first grade ever came to this sentence and said, I got to go to the Catholic school down the block because it says, let us make man. Nobody in seventh grade, no adult, whoever opened the Chumash, became an apikoros because it says this. But apikorsim, bring a proof from here. Harotza litos, if a person wants to make a mistake, then he can find anything to distort. His heart colors his eyes. The Rambam says, that's why a person who sins is called a blind person. Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Because his desires blind his eyes from seeing the truth. If you just open your eyes and look at the world objectively, you'll see the truth. You'll see there's a God. If you don't want to believe in God, your heart will color your vision and blind your eyes from seeing the truth. And that is the answer to the questions we started with. Why does it say don't go after your heart for false ideologies? Because that's where they are. They're not in your mind. Your mind, if you would see things in a objective way, you'd see them the right way. But you don't want to see them. Your heart colors your vision and distorts it, and you see what you want to see. You believe what you want to believe. And that's why Aristotle, with all his wisdom, didn't believe in God, not because he was smart. No, because he couldn't control his desires. But every 12-year-old girl and 13-year-old boy is able to control their desires. You don't have to be as smart as Aristotle to be in God, to believe in God. You just have to be objective. And every 12-year-old and 13-year-old could be objective, and Aristotle could be not objective. And that's the mitzvah. The mitzvah, belief in God, is not the knowledge that there's a God. Everybody has that knowledge deep down inside. The question is, will you acknowledge it? That's what Rav Shlomo Shofar Hirsch says. The mitzvah of belief in God is not the knowledge that there's a God, but the acknowledgement, accepting that knowledge, not ignoring it, not distorting it. That's what it is. And people believe what they want to believe. If you have what you want, you'll make everything fit that. My father, Olav HaShalom, once told me a joke. Said there was once a person who thought he was a zombie, a living dead person. And he was sure that he was a zombie, that he had died, come back, and he was a living dead person. So they put him in an insane asylum. And he still was sure that he was a zombie. So they took a psychiatrist to come and try to convince him he's not a zombie. So the psychiatrist tried to talk some sense into this guy, and nothing that he said could help. The guy was 100% convinced that he was a living dead person. Finally, the psychiatrist says to him, "I understand that zombies don't bleed." He said, "That's true." So the psychiatrist takes out a scissor and jabs the guy in the hand, and blood spurts out of his hand. He says, "What do you say now?" He says, "I guess zombies do bleed." You see what you want to see, and you believe what you want to believe. Okay, I'm not going to finish this today. We're going to finish it, but I just want to tell you one more story of where I saw, you could see it for yourself, but from yourself you don't really see it. But I once had a situation in Miami many, many years ago, and I'm very wary to say anything because people here know people in Miami. Yeah, I'm debating whether I should say this because I'm just afraid that somebody may know who I'm talking about, but I don't think so. It goes back many, many years, and you'd never guess who it was. In any case, I had a bala boss in Miami who was a little eccentric, to put it mildly. Very fine person, but eccentric. One day he burst into my office. He said, "Rabbi, save my daughter." So I said, "Calm down. What's with your daughter? She was hit by a car. She has a terrible disease. I'm not a doctor. I'm not Hatzalah. How am I going to save your daughter?" He said, "No, my daughter is going out. She met a young man, and she is interested in marrying this guy. He hasn't asked her yet, but if he'll ask her, she's for it. I met this guy, and he went to describe him as a combination of Hitler, Genghis Khan, and Haman, all wrapped into one. This guy is the most terrible person who ever walked on this earth, and if he marries my daughter, he's going to destroy her, destroy our family, and probably destroy the world. So save my daughter. She can't marry this guy." I said, "Well, did you tell her all of this?" "Yeah." He said, "But for some reason, she doesn't listen to me. I wonder why." But in any case, so I understood why the daughter would not be affected by what her father said, because she knew that her father was a little eccentric, to say the least. So I said, "Listen, you know, we both know that sometimes you come up with really wild ideas, and I find it very hard to believe that a boy learning in yeshiva is as bad as you portray him. But let me make a deal with you. I am going to meet this guy by accident. It's going to look like an accident. I'm going to bump into him and have a conversation. If what you portray is true, then I'll be lucky to get out of there with my life, and it'll be very obvious that this guy is really not for your daughter. But if I meet him and speak to him and I see what you're saying is not true, then I want you to give me your word that you won't stand in her way, and if she wants to marry this guy, you'll let her." So he gave me his word, and I bumped into this guy by accident during the week. I found out where he eats lunch. when they're off from yeshiva in the afternoon. And I met him in a pizza shop by accident, and bumped into him and sat down at the same table he was at and struck up a conversation. And we must have talked for about 45 minutes. At the end of the 45 minutes, I realized this guy's obviously not as bad as the father said, but there's something not normal about him. He's not a normal person. Something seriously wrong with his mental state. So I said, okay, now I'm going to keep my part of the bargain. He's not as bad as the father said, but he's definitely not for this girl. This girl's a nice, normal girl. She'll marry this guy, Taka. It's not for her. The guy's not normal. So I figured, she's not going to listen to her father, but why in the world wouldn't she listen to me? And I'm going to tell her black on white facts of things that I saw in a 45-minute conversation that this guy's off the wall. So I sit down with her, I call her in, I said, I understand that you're going out with so-and-so, and you're considering, you know, getting married to him. I said, you know, I happened to bump into this guy during the week, and I struck up a conversation, and I found out some very, very seriously bad things about his character. Now, I don't remember what the things were, but just for argument's sake, right, let me tell you how bad it was. If I would have told this girl, you know, I did some research on this guy, and I found out that he's murdered 7 wives, she would look back at me and say, I know that, but he did it with such sensitivity. I'm telling you, the guy's a murderer. He killed 7 wives. And you're telling me he's sensitive? And everything I would say that in my mind was so clear that this guy was something wrong with him, she would turn it into something positive. Why? Because I was looking objectively at this guy. I had nothing against him or for him. I surely wasn't infatuated with him, and therefore, what's it called, it didn't make a difference to me one way or the other. I saw things very objectively. But she liked this guy. She had feelings for him. And I'll call Pshoyim Techasa Ahava. When you like something, when you're in love with something, then you don't see its flaws. And not only that, you see them completely different. You see them in a very subjective way. And what I saw as clearly negative, she turned everything into positive. Baruch Hashem, after a while, I convinced her. And this guy went on to lead a very tragic life. Very tragic. And the girl, Baruch Hashem, was safe from that. But Harotza, a person who wants to see what they want to see, that's what they see. That's the way the world is. So a person, in order to be a believer in God, has to be an objective person. The more subjective you are, the less chance you have to believe in God, because your subjectivity, your desires, are going to blind your eyes from seeing the truth. Next week we will continue with this, but just to end with one point, what's the difference between a window and a mirror? A window, you see the whole world, and a mirror, you see yourself. What's the difference between them? A little kesef, a little silver. If you smear some silver on the window, all you see is yourself. Once you have kesef, means money, but it also means desire. Once you have those desires mixed in, then all you see is yourself and what you want to see. And if you don't have that kesef, then you can see the entire world. Next week we will see how that impacts on doing chesed or not doing chesed.